and you're listening to the TransFM Internet Broadcasting Network live at transfm.org. We're here with Denise LeClaire, the Executive Director of the International Foundation for Gender Education, the oldest and largest organization in the country. Welcome to the show, Denise.
Hi, Ethan. It's great to be here.
We're going to be discussing, or Denise is going to actually be discussing, the DSM-5, its implications, what it means, doing a DSM-101 for folks who don't understand or know what it means, and I'll let you take it from here.
Okay. I guess I'm going to do mostly monologue, though, but I know Ethan won't be able to keep his mouth shut that long, so it won't just be me. But okay, so a lot of people might have heard that there's a new version of the DSM that's just come out, the version 5, or it's the version's not out yet. It's actually just the proposed revisions, and so it's a comment period right now. But a lot of people don't know what the DSM is. They don't know how it affects our lives, and so this is just kind of to get people up to speed a little bit. So for people who are experts in this, if you've got a degree in psychology, I apologize. This show is not for you. But for everybody else out there who's not a psychological expert, we'll try to explain things so that you know how that you can be part of this. The DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association. This is the list of all the psychological disorders that they might diagnose you with. This is important to psychiatrists and psychologists all around the world because it largely determines what's considered to be a mental illness and what things the insurance company might pay for. Transgender people have been listed in the DSM since 1973. Unfortunately, unlike most other conditions, our insurance companies still don't pay for the treatment, so it hasn't been all that helpful to us. A lot of doctors wanted it listed early on because they felt that it would legitimize treating transgender people. So I talked to Dr. Stanley Biber, who's pretty famous for being one of the pioneers of SRS, and he was really proud of the fact that he had helped get transgender people in the DSM because it legitimized his medical practice, that he could, you know, do this. And even though the insurance companies wouldn't reimburse the people for getting the procedure, he could at least get malpractice insurance, which is a really important aspect of this, because if doctors can't get malpractice insurance, they're simply not going to practice. So in 1973, at the same time as they were removing homosexuality, or pretty much at the same time, they put in transsexuality into this diagnostic manual from the APA. And again, a lot of people thought that this was a good thing, but it was kind of a deal with the devil. In a way, we got access to better medical care as a result of that. There's no question about that fact, that we got much better medical care once we had a diagnosable condition. But the downside of it is that we were always going to be known as having a mental illness, when most transgender people that I know and most of the psychologists who work with transgender people don't really see this as a mental illness. And as a result of that, we face an awful lot of prejudice. I know people lose their security clearances, and you know, it's, you have that stigma attached to having a psychological disorder that follows you around. And it's the only psychological disorder that working, having some kind of a medical procedure to some other part of your body other than your brain, supposedly cures the disorder. So there's some real inconsistencies with even calling this a psychological disorder. It really doesn't meet the criteria of a psychological disorder, but it's kind of convenient for it to be there in that respect. But so we've been listed now since 1973. So that's like 40 years that we've been in the DSM, and we still don't have insurance coverage for this. So, I mean, as a strategy, being in the DSM has not been a great strategy for us, at least not in terms of getting civil rights. When you see people criticize trans people, almost universally they say, well, these are people who have a severe psychological disorder. They don't need surgery, they need counseling. And so it sort of perpetuates that idea that if we just had good counseling, or if they gave us the right drugs or something like that, that it would cure us of this problem. Because even our critics recognize that this doesn't really fit as a psychological disorder, and so they use that against us.
How does the Harry Benjamin standards of care fit in with that it's a psychological disorder when the Harry Benjamin had said that, well, you know, these are the, this is the, what you have to do as a transsexual person, transitioning to live full time, and you know the prescribed, and to end up with having sex reassignment surgery, which is what Harry Benjamin said. How does that fit with the DSM, or does it at all?
Well, because they're using psychologists, or actually more of the time social workers, to quote unquote diagnose transsexuals as to whether or not we should be getting medical treatments for this condition, that they've set out a standard, and the psychiatrists or social workers who are working with us are basically looking at the DSM for guidance, and most people believe that you have to, for someone to be able to get hormones or to get surgery, that you have to have a letter that specifically states you've been diagnosed with gender identity disorder. But although the standards imply that, they don't say that explicitly. So doctors can actually get a letter of referral from your therapist that doesn't say that you've been diagnosed with gender identity disorder, and it meets the standards of care. But most therapists don't know this, and most doctors don't know this, and so there's a presumption that you need to have an explicit diagnosis of gender identity disorder in order to access medical care.
As if it's the law, when it's not a law.
No, it's not a law. And you know, they looked at this a lot in the most recent case from the IRS, and in terms of medical standards, these are considered somewhat weak. They're not that enforceable. And, you know, the standards of care are sort of a whole different thing from the DSM, although they do interrelate. And again, the standards of care are the rules more or less around accessing medical care for transgender people, and they're put out by a different organization. It used to be the Harry Benjamin International Gender Dysphoria Association, but everybody gets sick of trying to say that, and it'd be easier to say Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers or something.
Pickled Packers.
Yeah, even better. But so they just changed it to WPATH, the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, which is also interesting because now instead of just regulating transsexuals, they're claiming to sort of oversee transgender people as though non-transsexuals are going to need some kind of psychological help as well.
And that's neither here nor there when it comes to how anybody's living their lives. If you're a transgender person and you're not, your gender isn't interfering in your life in any way, shape, or form, how would that be, how would you be diagnosed with a psychological disorder, or why?
Right, and you shouldn't be diagnosed with a psychological disorder, but the DSM makes this all very murky. So I guess just to step back a little bit and clarify, the list of psychological disorders is the DSM. The group that puts the DSM out is the American Psychiatric Association. But the organization that oversees transgender care more specifically is WPATH, which used to be HBGDA, and the thing that they put out are called the standards of care, and the standards of care are based on the DSM. So they're sort of, they work in conjunction, but they're separate things. And so I think as a community, we want to approach WPATH and try to get them to move away from requiring that diagnosis of GID to access medical care. And then independently from that, we want to be working with the American Psychiatric Association. Ultimately, I think the right thing to do is to get gender identity disorder out of the DSM completely. And internationally, that's definitely the way the transgender movement is going, is to take it out completely. But to do that and still be able to get medical care, we'd need to have some alternative diagnosis, something somatic, something with our body as opposed to something with our minds. And we don't have any consensus right now on what kind of condition you, how you would frame that to be able to have an alternative diagnosis. So for the time being, it is relatively useful for transsexuals to have a diagnosis that will help them get access to medical care. But for anybody who's not a transsexual, the last thing you want is to be in the DSM.
Well, actually, all they're doing then at that point is pathologizing your either sexual preference or your gender presentation at any given time.
Yeah, just the fact that you're gender variant in your gender expression is enough to get you a diagnosis of some sort.
Well, that's most of the people in our country. How many people actually fit that black and white of male and female, men and women? It doesn't, you know, what they show on television and in magazines is absolutely not what you see in everyday life. Go to a supermarket, go to a mall, go and stand in the middle of a square on a busy city street and look at people.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the draft revision for the new version of the DSM just came out this week. It's all the rounds in the newspapers. It's in the New York Times this week. It's in the LA Times, and they were talking about it on NPR today. And on NPR, they were having this whole discussion. It really didn't specifically talk about, you know, transgender people, but just about the DSM overall, because they're making a lot of changes in the DSM, and it makes it so it's more of a net that pulls everybody in, and people are noticing this, that pretty much everybody's diagnosable. And the commentator on NPR on the show today said that she had read a study which indicated that in New York, if you looked at the people, you'd find that 84% of the people in New York would have some diagnosable condition in the old version of the DSM, and it just got bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And so under the old version, if you could pull in 84% of the population, I'm thinking they're shooting for 100%. You know, it would be a great boom for the drug companies. Maybe that'll help us in the economy if we can get everybody taking some kind of a drug for some sort of condition that they have.
You know, one of the things that I understand that completely, because that's one of the things you and I had talked about earlier is, you know, drug companies, if you're a doctor and you're trying to get back into to become relevant, mm-hmm. or more relevant, or to be forgiven or whatever it is that you've done in the past, the best way to do it is to go through the drug companies, get them to lobby for you, because why not? Everybody's going to make a buck at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very interesting way to approach this, to see how it's wrong, how it's not helping people, but helping line people's pockets instead. One of the things that in the New York Times that bothered me, and most people don't read through the whole article, but the last paragraph of the article of the New York Times bothered me the most. This is what it says. It says, with all of its imperfections, the DSM serves an important purpose for psychiatrists and doctors in general practice. That doesn't mean therapists can't be alert to specific complaints from their patients that confound or combine the categories. As with the Bible, in some cases, the manual should be taken not literally, but seriously.
Yeah.
That irked me. That irked the crap out of me. Look, I'm
a... Well, you know, in a lot of ways, psychology has taken the place of religion in our society, that they've become the arbiters of what's right and wrong. You know, we consider that we're sort of post-moral in a lot of ways, or post-religious, but really it's just been turned over to people who claim that it's a science.
Right.
And I have a lot of respect for psychologists, but I still have always felt that it's an art and not really a science, mostly.
My issue is just keeping religion out of it altogether, and why mention the Bible at all?
Well, I mean, they're very similar. People refer to the DSM as the Bible of
psychology. Right.
And again, I also want to point out that there's two different APAs, that there's the American Psychiatric Association, and psychiatrists are medical doctors who have studied psychology.
And can write prescriptions.
And so in a lot of ways, they're sort of the retail outlet for the drug companies. And this is very much done from a drug company-centric perspective. A lot of times they'll invent a new drug and they'll find that it has a particular effect. I believe there was a drug that came out that made people less inhibited. And so I remember hearing stories about, well, you can look for the next version of the DSM to have some sort of a diagnosis for social phobias. And sure enough, you know, one of the new ones is that there's social anxiety disorder. We
Paxil.
Used to just be shy, but now you can have Paxil.
Right.
And really it was the development of a drug that changed people's behavior in a way that somebody said, we can market to this, and all of a sudden there's a diagnosis to go along with that drug so that you can get it covered by insurance policy.
And this is all big money, and it might not have anything to do with really getting better mental health or having better physical health.
Yeah.
It's just it's lining people's pockets.
But there's a different APA also. There's the American Psychological Association, which is psychologists, and those are people who just study psychology, and they're not medical doctors. They're specialists in psychology, and they can't write prescriptions. The American Psychological Association has endorsed medical access for transgender people and has actually been really good. So there's like a good APA and a not-so-good APA. I wouldn't quite call them evil, but some of the stuff they do, I believe, harms people. Mm-hmm. And I believe a lot of what they're doing in the DSM harms people. So it's important, I think, to keep those two organizations clear that they're not the same thing.
So, Denise, thank you so much for clearing up the differences in the APAs. That's always I see things posted all the time online, and people get them confused a lot. So that's thanks
when
for
they're
doing
confusing.
That.
And when I say that I think that they've hurt people, you know, I said already that there's a huge stigma that comes along with having this psychological diagnosis. But I think, besides just the stigma, it changes the very way that people think about us, the way that doctors think about us, and you know, it casts the whole thing in a very negative light, at least in the way that our society perceives things. You know, they can say, well, it shouldn't be that way, and maybe it shouldn't, but it is.
People perceive psychological disorders as being somehow less than. That shouldn't be to begin with, and that needs to change. That's something that we absolutely have to work on as a society. But in the meantime, this still should not be a psychological disorder. Those are still two separate issues.
And in the NPR show that they did about the DSM today, I was really happy to hear that the very last line on the show, the commentator was saying that perhaps the most damaging thing of all about the DSM is that it brings up the idea that there is something called normal.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that I go off on a lot, is people saying, using that word, because that always suggests that there's something abnormal.
That there's a right way to be, that this is the way that everybody should be. And if you're not that way, then there's something wrong with you. And so this is...
And if there's something wrong with you, then it also goes even further into the moral or immoral.
Right, which goes back to what I was saying about that psychology in a lot of ways has sort of taken the place of religion, because this is very much moralizing on what's the right way to be and what's the wrong way to be. And in that respect, they've taken a whole bunch of different behaviors and basically said that these behaviors in and of themselves are disordered, like cross-dressing. So we have a diagnosis of transvestic fetishism in there, and it serves no purpose. That you can be diagnosed with transvestic fetishism strictly based on gender nonconforming behavior. So just based on the way that you behave, something that's okay for a woman to do is not okay for a man to do. And also it's interesting that that's the only diagnosis that can only be given to a male. There, you can't be, according to the DSM, a transvestic fetishist if you're female.
Which is bias in and of itself.
Which is absolutely bias. And so one of the things that IFGE has called for, and Kelly Winters, who's the head of GIDReform.org, who's been an advocate for reforming the DSM criteria for a long time, is I think a lot of us agree that transvestic fetishism should just be removed, because it turns cross-dressing into an illness, and it's not. It's not an illness. It doesn't belong in there. There's nothing wrong with someone who's a cross-dresser, and it just reinforces the stereotype against cross-dressers that there's something intrinsically wrong with them, and then society makes the jump to think that we're some kind of sex offenders.
That, and I have to say this, I was speaking to a friend of mine last night who works at a spa. And it's there's a lot of young people that work there too. A guy came in, mm-hmm. and he had various hair removal things done to him, and he said that a friend of him was coming over with a change of clothes. He was a cross dresser, so he felt comfortable enough and safe enough. He spent a lot of money at the spa to have things done. And the younger people in there were labeling him, came out and were like giggling and laughing and really making fun of him as being a sex offender and this and that, saying all kinds of things in the lobby. And my friend was there and she said, oh, no, this is a crossdresser, you don't understand, and had to explain. And thankfully, she was there to tell them what this was. This is one of the reasons why that happens. People misunderstand, misinterpret what it means to be a crossdresser because we're diagnosed. Well, I'm not a crossdresser, but because transgender people are misdiagnosed or diagnosed at all. Why would you be? To say something like that. They actually equated this guy without even knowing him. His or anything about him that, oh, he must have been a pedophile. I mean, they were just saying a bunch, and I'm just saying this, in a social awareness that this is still going on out there among young people and professionals, and it's not people don't know enough about what it means to be a crossdresser, so it's some of these things just. And they take what people tell them, and a lot of it comes from psychology, psychiatry, from the DSM. Where else are you going to get this?
Yeah, and so it's not just seen as being an illness,
right? It's a trickle down, though, from the people that must know, the professionals must know.
Because this is what normal people do, and anything outside that. It's like saying, okay, well, if you drink coffee in the morning, you're normal. But if you drink tea, there's an illness. You must have Britishophilia or something.
Britishophilia.
You drink tea. That's just not right. It's just some people have a preference
sweet
for one
tea.
Thing. Yeah, sweet tea. Well, we're not going to comment on that. I don't want to alienate too many people.
We can always cut this out of the conversation.
Okay, sweet tea.
You did that with a southern accent. That's why I said that. I'm like...
but it's pathologizing something that's just part of the normal range of human behavior.
All of it's a normal range of human behavior. And that goes back to that there's never been a decent study other than... what the hell's his name? Kinsey, there's never been a real decent study on human sexuality and human behavior when it comes to sex, gender. Go a step further. I mean, really, that's
because people don't want to admit. They're afraid that this is going to be used against them. And when it
what
comes right
is
down,
normal is all of this. Everything.
And my theory has always been that if you get to know somebody well, if you actually really know them, they're really weird. Everybody's got something that most people would think is really weird. It's different for everyone. And it doesn't matter how normal you seem. I think the more normal you look, the more strange you are if you scratch the surface. So the people who look really crazy normal, like Pat Robertson, I mean, they've just got to be something really deeply disturbed below the surface, and they're working really hard to cover it up.
And there's sexual skeletons in everybody's closet. Because and we keep them to ourselves because we're afraid that if we tell people what it is that turns us on, what we like, what we want,
we're going to be judged. And the DSM are the standards against which we would be judged.
Right.
And according to that, all gender variant behavior is essentially an illness, and that is in and of itself harmful. It results in discrimination against transgender people by governments, by companies, by other individuals, by groups. It just becomes a pervasive part of our culture that it's okay to discriminate against us because we're sick. We're not like those people.
And actually, you and I had discussed also Blanchard's paper from last year, where he had... Was it Blanchard's paper?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Blanchard's trying to rewrite the very idea of what a paraphilia is, basically a fetish.
And in doing so, attacking pretty much all sexual behavior that he deems to be, and I'm going to do a little quotation marks in the air here, abnormal, so to speak. That's paraphrasing, but who gets to decide that? He's setting the guidelines to what he believes is normal sexual behavior, and pathologizing everything else which he doesn't believe it, which he believes not to be. So,
His new definition. If you bear with me for 1 second here.
Sure. I know you're flipping through your pages.
I actually, all the stuff that they've thrown out there, I started printing these things out, and then I started stapling them together, and then there was so much stuff that's come out in the last couple of weeks. I have a whole three-ring binder full of wonderful stuff about how sick we transgender people are. So the new definition is going to be recurrent, intense, sexually arousing fantasies, sexual urges or behaviors generally involving non-human objects, the suffering or humiliation of oneself or one's partner, children, or atypical focus involving human subjects. Actually, I think that's the old one. Here we go. Here's what Blanchard would like to see the new one be. The term paraphilia denotes any intense and persistent sexual interest other than sexual interest in genital stimulation or preparatory fondling with phenotypically normal consenting adult human partners. And so there's a whole bunch of this that's disturbing. One of the most disturbing things is phenotypically normal. And so if you behave in any sort of sexual way, if you're attracted to your husband or to your wife and there's something different about them, maybe their nose is misshapen, maybe they've got a missing limb,
blue eyes,
or they're overweight or they're thin, or something that he deems to not be phenotypically normal, that you have a fetish, that you have a paraphilia, you have a diagnosable mental illness because you're attracted to somebody who's not, according to him, phenotypically normal.
And that definition can change as time goes by. What phenotypically normal might mean to him today might not mean the same tomorrow, and that can change in the DSM if that's what, that's where this is going, obviously. This is what, you know,
well, that, yeah, it's the direction that he's trying to push all of this, is that any sexual interest in genital stimulation and preparatory fondling. So does that mean, like, for a man, if you're interested in breasts, which are technically not genitals, if you're a breast man, does that mean that you have a paraphilia? Actually, I'm going to propose a new one right here. This is the world premiere. I think that we need to look at heterophilia. I think that there are a lot of people out there with an unnatural interest, an obsession with heterosexuality, that they're just completely obsessed with people who, of the opposite sex, to the point where it probably is debilitating. And strangely enough, I don't see heterophilia in the DSM. I think that they've really missed out on an opportunity to diagnose everyone else.
And heterophilia would, those right-wing people that are trying to get to stop gay marriage, that they spend and obsess all of their time.
I know so many people who are just like constantly talking about people of the opposite sex. They watch them on TV. They're drooling over them. They're just constantly obsessed with them. And I think that that's not normal.
Well, and think about this. I mean, you see it on TV everywhere. How horrible is that for folks that aren't?
I know. They're trying to indoctrinate the children.
Yes, and this is the way that they work.
You know, and I don't mind if those heterophiliacs are going to be that way, but do they have to flaunt it? You know, they're putting pictures of their opposite sex partners on their desks
The internet.
Yes, they're wearing jewelry that tells the whole world that they're heterosexual.
They hold hands walking down the street in broad daylight.
I've seen them kissing in public. It's true. Heterophilia, you heard it here first.
Live on Trans FM.
But seriously, I think that people are materially harmed by this categorization of human behavior into what's acceptable and what's not acceptable, when they can't demonstrate that there's any harm.
Who gets to decide? And that's just it as well. Why is it that this person gets to decide what is what is the norm?
And in terms of the group of people who are working on revising the chapter, the section that affects transgender people, there's Blanchard and there's Zucker, and these people are self-proclaimed experts in this subject. I think that they have an obsession, an unnatural obsession with transgender people. And so you've got Blanchard who's publishing, along with Zucker, the Archives of Sexual Behavior. So they've got their own so-called medical journal. And when they're making these revisions to the DSM, they're citing their own papers published in their own journal and saying that this makes it established science. So that's so amazingly incestuous, it's hard to believe that they're taken seriously. And even more intriguing is that they're not psychiatrists. What the hell is going on? They're writing the manual on psychiatry, and they're not psychiatrists.
No, you'd think that they would have to have a higher education in order
to be
able to
do this.
So they
don't have the right credentials, and the things that they're basing these changes on that affect people's lives. These affect whether people are going to be able to get jobs, whether they're going to get access to medical care, and all they're seeing is that, yay, they get to have another paper published. You know,
and,
bravo for them.
And again, to have pharmaceutical companies on their side, because who is not going to, and the pharmaceutical companies say, oh no, we're not going to believe this, we're not going to take this into consideration, when it's only going to make them more money. And we all know that that is the direction that pharmaceutical companies lean towards. So it's, you know, we already have our physicians saying that if you come into my office and I diagnose you with this, I better prescribe you this medication, or else I'm going to be deducted points in my evaluation.
Yeah, they'll get less money from the reimbursement of the insurance companies because they didn't put you on statin, or they didn't put you on high blood pressure medication, or whatever it is.
And that's I wonder if psychiatrists are going to end up being scored the same way, or if they already are, that other medical doctors are when it comes to medication that's prescribed through the Psychiatric Association.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see this as being objective science by any means. And, you know, and in this version of the DSM, there's an unprecedented grab to diagnose everyone, where before there was a certain threshold that you had to reach. You had to, at the very least, according to the previous versions of the DSM, have clinically significant distress, which meant that somehow that you couldn't function in some part of your life because this problem caused you so much distress. You couldn't hold down a job, or you couldn't have natural, when you couldn't have sexual relationships with your partner, that something, some part of your life was fundamentally broken because of the stress that you were experiencing because of this problem. And now they're sort of doing away with that line and saying, well, then it's a matter of degree. So now for all these different conditions, they have a separate questionnaire to determine how intense your discomfort is, not just do you have this level or not? And they're saying that this is better somehow because they'll be able to weed people out, but I think it actually means that they can pull more people in. So, I mean, almost everyone at some point in their life becomes depressed over something. Maybe you've just lost a parent. Maybe you've just lost a pet. If you've had a dog for 16 years and your dog dies, you're going to be really depressed.
Maybe you're being discriminated against in your job, and that's why you can't function at work. It's not generally because of who you are. It's because of who people see you as.
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons why you might be moderately depressed. But in the past, just being depressed, it's an emotion. It's not an illness. But now, if it's just a matter of degree, then if you're depressed, then that's to some degree a mental disorder.
Well, there's a difference between being clinically depressed and being upset.
Well, there was, but I guess what I'm saying now is that the most recent proposed revisions, they've blurred that line, that there's no longer a clear distinction just between being upset, being depressed over some real reason, something that went bad in your life, and having clinically, you know, what used to be considered clinical depression. Which was, you know,
and now they're putting people on, because they wanted to put people on medication for everything. This, you know, as long as you're being diagnosed with this, well, there's a medication to match it.
40% of college students are on antidepressants now. 40% of all of our college students. These should be the people whose minds are working at their peak efficiency. I mean, college students, graduate students, these are people who should have the most brilliant minds out of our entire society, and we're medicating them all. And that just can't be good. Not
and children. It's not just college students. It's also children who are hyperactive. Or stop feeding them sugar. Well, that's another issue, of course. But hyperactive children are being put on still even Ritalin. Drugs to it just goes on and on and on.
I know, we need to get them on Riddle out. It's the antidote.
The antidote, yeah.
Riddle in?
Riddle out. It's puppy uppers, doggy downers.
But I mean, we've got all these people on antidepressants now. We've made it a crime to choose your own drug. I mean, we've made all the recreational substances illegal, but then given people complete free rein. If it comes from a pharmaceutical company, it's okay. And these drugs cause thousands of deaths every year. And yet, if you make the decision that I feel better, want to have a drink, or I feel better if I smoke pot or something like that, that's a crime. And they've shown that most antidepressant drugs are not any more effective at reducing depression than placebos.
In fact, if you really, and I've talked to so many people who are on antidepressants recently who have said, well, I can't climax, or I can't have sex with my partner. I no longer have a libido. It's blah 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 blah. I talked to a friend of mine who said to me, because I was suffering from anxiety, I didn't want to go on drugs that would make me numb from the waist down or from the neck up, And she said, okay, well, how about try valerian root, blah blah blah, mm-hmm. Over the counter. $4.95 for a bottle of 100, 500 milligrams. If I start feeling panicky at night, I take one about 6 o'clock at 9 o'clock. I'm asleep. I'm all happy. I get up. I'm refreshed. I'm fine. It's non-addictive. Yay. You're not going to see a doctor say to you, well, why don't you try this? Or how about getting out of the house every once in a while?
Yeah, they've shown that regular exercise is more effective than antidepressants for most people.
What the heck do you call it when you're
sex?
No. When you exercise, it's known to actually
endorphins.
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 Your endorphins,
yes.
Kick in. Thank you. You knew what I was talking about.
But you get endorphins from sex as well.
Well, from sex, yes, and people become addicted to sex as well. And that's because of the effects of endorphins. And
well, there's
that
whole,
could be
there's
a feel,
whole
yeah.
thing is sexual addiction in the newest version of the DSM.
Oh, imagine that.
They've added a whole bunch of new addictions.
And I'm sure there's drugs for that. Oh, that's probably an antidepressant because it stops you.
But the
friend that I was talking to actually was saying to me that he said, I'm on antidepressants. I can't be in a relationship with anybody now because I can't climax. I don't have a sex drive. My libido's gone. Why would they think that I'd be less depressed?
It doesn't make sense.
Lonely.
And what
he's
these,
lonely.
These
and
things
sex.
That they're calling antidepressants actually tend to depress you, in my opinion. They're downers. And they're depressants.
They're repressing you.
You know, if they were really antidepressants, wouldn't they be like speed? I don't understand how something that sort of numbs you that much is an antidepressant. It doesn't make sense to me. We're getting a little off topic, but not completely.
No, and it's okay. We can
because we're talking about the DSM.
Out.
But now I know someone who's a good friend of mine who has been under a lot of distress because I think they're really a transsexual, and they're in a position where because of their family and because of their job they really can't transition, and that makes them very upset. And so they went to a psychiatrist who saw them for a fairly brief period of time and put them on an antidepressant, and specifically put them on an antidepressant with the highest rate of causing impotence, because the psychiatrist, not understanding any of this stuff and just based on what it says in the DSM, assumed that this was simply a sexual fetish, and that if we give you an antidepressant that also makes makes you impotent, that once you lose your sex drive, you won't want to be transgender anymore, which shows a fundamental lack of understanding about transgender people. And I mean, humans. Yeah.
Why wouldn't you want to have sex with your partner?
Losing their sex drive is a worst case scenario for most of the men that I know, and not a few women, you know, and it just doesn't make sense to me.
Your partner goes away.
So this is why a lot of the stuff in the DSM is bad, and specifically why it's bad for transgender people, and especially for people who are not looking for medical care. A lot of people are making the argument that being in the DSM serves an important purpose for transsexual people, and right now it does. We don't have an alternate diagnosis to be able to get access to medical care. So you can make the argument that transsexuals, at least for now, for the time being, need to stay in the DSM. Maybe we can come up with a better way to categorize things the next time this comes up, but it doesn't come up very often. Every 10 or 20 years, they change the DSM.
Do you think that the AMA, the American Medical Association, a few years ago actually had said that, well, you need to treat transsexuals medically?
Yeah.
And do you think that that has helped or could move us from a psychological or a psychiatric diagnosis to a medical one?
I think it's
one.
Kind of agnostic in that regard. They're certainly acknowledging, both the American Psychological Association and the American Medical Association, both acknowledge that treating transsexuals, what they call the triad of psychotherapy, hormones, and sex reassignment surgery, is effective for dealing with this condition. But none of them have taken a stance on whether it belongs as a psychiatric diagnosis or whether it belongs as a somatic, as a something's wrong with your body.
Well, and because it's such an up in the air jumble, do you think that that's why insurance companies have been so skittish about covering it, because they can't really place us?
Well, insurance companies don't make money by covering your illness. They make money by taking your money and not paying for the thing that you have. And so they've been able to use the lack of consensus to justify withholding payments. And they're going to do that as long as they can. There's no incentive for them to give us money if they can find some excuse not to. They're for-profit corporations. Most of the time, they're for-profit corporations. And they're going to make more money if they don't cover our condition. And so unless they have to, unless we can make a compelling argument and get consensus in the medical community, they're going to keep, you know, dodging out on that.
Well, and in that same on that same track, what is what do you think about our government taking over and our insurance having a socialized insurance? And do you where will we fit in there? Will we be covered? How will they see us? Will they be doing the same dance?
I mean, in general principles, I think that ultimately this country has to go to a single-payer medical system, that the system that we have right now is just wrong because people make money off of other people's suffering. Any system that turns people's disease and suffering into a for-profit corporation, it's not going to be good for the people. And so in an overall sense, I really want to see healthcare reform happen. For transgender people specifically, though, it makes me very much afraid, because right now the private insurers are not covering this because they've been taking advantage of the lack of consensus to avoid that. And I think if the government comes in and has a single-payer system, that they're going to end up adopting all the same stereotypes that the insurance companies have right now overall, and that it's going to be much harder to change. Right now, we're dealing with a bunch of different insurance companies, and they're big, and they're hard to get them to change, but it's possible. When we have a monolithic insurance system, I think it's going to be really a whole lot harder, in that politicians are going to get involved, and because transgender people are not popular politically, that it's going to be really hard for us to make the argument that we deserve equal access to medical care. And I'm so sick of hearing this argument that this is something that we've chosen. that's, first of all, it's wrong. Being transgender is nothing that anybody would choose. It doesn't make any sense that people would choose this. And even if we did, insurance companies pay for you to be put back together if you have a skiing accident. They don't say, well, you were skiing. That was a lifestyle choice.
If you smoke cigarettes
and you get lung cancer, your illness is covered. If you're overweight and you have a heart attack, your condition is covered. All of these are things that are a result of people's choices. If you're diabetic because you eat cookies every day for lunch, for breakfast, and for dinner, your condition is still covered by insurance companies. Most of the stuff that people come down with is caused by their lifestyle. It's their choice. Being transgender is not a choice, and yet they claim that it is, and then they use that as a justification to withhold payment. That is so hypocritical that it makes me want to scream sometimes.
And it makes me want to scream all of the time. But
most of the time.
And well, this is why you do what you do. This is why you're the executive director of IFGE, because you are an activist and this is what you do. You saw all of these things and it did make you scream, and you're screaming it now.
Yeah, I mean, people say, that's it, I'm not going to be an activist anymore. And it's like, oh no. Nobody chooses to be an activist. You're an activist because you can't keep your mouth shut. You see these things, you see that they're wrong, and you can't stay quiet about it. And that's what makes somebody an activist. And you can't turn that off and on. I can tell people that I'm not going to be an activist, but I'm not going to be able to keep my mouth shut. And when I get up there and start yelling about these problems, right off the bat, I've become an activist again. So.
Right. The light comes on. Well, what can people do to help IFGE and to be more of an activist, or to help the organization? I mean, IFGE is a phenomenal organization. I've always said that, and I will continue to.
Well, I mean, we can use all the members that we have. It gives us credibility when we go to organizations like the American Psychiatric Association, and we can say that we have thousands of members in the organization, and we represent those people, and we need to see these things change. The more people who are behind us, the more weight our word has. And so there's definitely strength in numbers. You know, right on every page of the draft DSM, at the bottom of the page, it says, representing over 38,000 medical professionals. And, you know, we need to have those kinds of numbers. We need to have 1,000. There's probably 3 million transgender people in this country. If we could get 1% of those transgender people to all be part of the movement and to stand up and speak out, we would be unstoppable. But most transgender people feel that they can't do that for one reason or another. But if we could, there are so many of us out there that we would have an amazing amount of power.
Well, please do.
Please do.
This is our invitation. You know, this is our movement and we're all invited.
And you know what? We're going to be gathering testimony and things like this, and we're going to be passing this on to the APA. So, you know, send us your comments. You can send it to IFG. You can find us online. It's www.ifge.org. And you can go there and you can sign up to be a member. You can join our mailing list. You can keep up on the updates on what's going on with the DSM. And for people who want to look at the new proposed revisions to the DSM, the website's www.dsm5.org. That's DSM in the numeral 5.org. And all the new revisions are there, and you can get a look at them yourself. Right now, they've been posted just a couple days ago for public comment. And so that's why we're going to be collecting a lot of people's, you know, feedback on this. And that comment period closes on April 20th. And so we've got about 8 weeks now to get out there and to get people to stand up and speak up and see if we can't get them to change some things. And really the things that we're trying to focus on the most, they've made a few changes to what used to be called gender identity disorder, which is the diagnosis they give to transsexuals. And now they're going to call it gender incongruency, which is a slightly less stigmatizing name. And so there's a little bit of improvement there. They've changed a few things that have made it marginally better. It used to be that if you were diagnosed, there was no way to not be suffering from that mental illness. So even if you were transsexual and you got a diagnosis of having gender identity disorder and you went through treatment, you saw your psychiatrist or your psychologist, you had hormone therapy, you had surgery, you're happy, you're well-adjusted, you no longer have any issues, under the old listings, you still had gender identity disorder. And so now they've put in an exit clause so that you can basically say, well, I used to have that, but I don't have it anymore.
Is there a difference in the definition between gender identity disorder and gender incongruency?
Minor differences. They changed some subtle wording in there. I think that we'll lose a lot of listeners if I start reciting the exact terminology involved. One of the things that I want to talk about where these things in the DSM have an effect far outside the realm that you would think of is that these are very frequently cited in legal cases. Now, just about a week ago, there was a woman, Rhiannon O'Donabain, who had her medical deduction for her treatment for being transgender disallowed by the IRS. And so she appealed it, and they allowed it, and then the IRS appealed it, and they disallowed it, and then it went to a tax court, and they finally issued a ruling a couple weeks ago. And in the ruling, it was a panel of judges. I think there were 9 judges. And the majority of the judges ruled that her medical expenses were deductible as legitimate medical expenses, just like any other medical expenses. But there was one judge who was one of the dissenting opinions. And when he made his case as to why it didn't make sense to allow, you know, SRS and hormone treatment to treat her gender identity disorder, he gave an argument which is actually logically nearly perfect, and that's what makes it so damaging. He was in the minority, and so this opinion didn't end up being the way the case was decided. But what he said was that when you look at the case of this patient, you can analyze the problem in one of two ways. The first way you could look at it is that this person's anatomical maleness is normative, and his perceived femaleness is the problem. So basically saying that your body is the part that's real and your mind is screwed up. So the body is normative, that your anatomical maleness is normative, and that your self-perception, your gender identity is the problem. Or you could flip it around and see that this person's perceived femaleness is normative, that's the part that's real, and their anatomical maleness is the problem. Now, that's the way that I see it, that my identity, my sense of self, my soul, if you will, is the part that's real.
And what causes you distress isn't your body.
No, it is.
It's how you see yourself, how you know yourself to be.
And how I know myself conflicts with my body.
Right.
But if you have to decide, and ultimately you have to decide one or the other is real and is not changeable. And society as a whole sees your body as being the part that's real, and that your mind is the part that's changeable. And the judge says that if you assume the second one, which is the way I feel, that your mind, your soul is the part that's real, then one could say that SRS does treat your gender identity disorder by bringing the problematic body into conformity with your mind. However, and this is where his reasoning is good, but it would have been really bad if he had been the majority. The medical consensus as described in the record of this case is in stark opposition to the latter characterization and can only be reconciled with the first option, which is that your body is the part that's real and your mind is the part that's not real. And so the judge actually reads these facts very clearly and interprets them in the way that I think, if you accept the medical's opinion, he would be right. Now, I dispute that medical interpretation. I've always insisted that my mind is fine. My identity is not disordered. My desk is disordered. My identity is who I am.
It's who you are, and that's indisputable.
But that's not how the medical society sees us. Because this is listed as a mental illness, that they don't see it that way at all. They see us as being delusional. They think that we're happier and that we're more productive if they give us access to reassignment surgery, but they don't think that it's real. They don't think that my identity is real. They think that my identity is an illness, and that I can't abide by that. My identity is not an illness. And the judge is correct in reading this. If you go by the medical the overarching medical opinion,
right,
that it doesn't make any sense that they would allow us to have reassignment surgery as a treatment for this disorder.
And if you take into consideration, even as babies, though, in the case with, I can't remember his name, he had a doctor had tried to complete a circumcision.
Oh, you're talking about the John Joan case?
John, yes.
With Dr. Money?
Dr. Money, and had burnt off his penis. Mm-hmm. And then they decided to complete sex reassignment surgery on him and then raise him as a girl. He knew it wasn't about his body. It was about who he knew himself to be.
Mm-hmm. So they had changed his body, but he always identified it as a male.
As a male.
Even though the doctors created a female body for him.
And tried to instill female characteristics and tried to instill female, this is what women do, let's societal issues that females went through, all of that. He still knew himself to be a boy.
There's a great quote in a can't think of the author. It might have been C.S. Lewis, but the quote is, "You don't have a soul. You are a soul. You have a body."
Right.
You know, and I think that speaks to this, that your soul is who you are, and the body is just the vessel that's carrying it. It doesn't dictate who you are. You know, people with birth, there are thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people with birth defects. It didn't make their souls defective. It didn't change who they are. Changing your body doesn't change who you are. And my sense of myself has never changed. No matter what my body looked like, no matter what anybody else perceived my body to be, my soul has always felt the same way.
And that's my argument has always simply been, you know what, if we were, and I know this is like, this is a dream or a far-fetched, but if we were put on an island where we didn't know anything about sex and gender, would we want to change our bodies? Would we know the difference? Would it be something that, you know, if we were accepted any way that we were, would it be that? Would we really conflict? Would our minds conflict with our bodies? Would it be... I'm not saying that I ever had a wrong body. That would suggest that there was a right one out there. It's just the idea that I don't know if society tells us this is what it means to be a man or a woman. I'm not talking about male and female. Those are separate than men and women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your gender and your sex are different. I don't know if I was born into a society that would have accepted me if I said, oh, no, I'm a guy. And they would have been, oh, okay. If I would have had to change anything about myself to make myself look more to what society is matching me to be a male. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I mean,
I don't know. Nobody's going to know that.
Sounds like the story of the ugly duckling.
But nobody's going to know the answer to that.
Yeah, you can't know. I mean, I think that I still would have been uncomfortable because I've always wanted to have sex in the female way, and I didn't have the right body parts to do that, and that always made me uncomfortable. And so, you know, a lot of transsexuals say, well,
regardless
it's not about
if sex. You want to have sex with a man or a woman, it didn't matter,
right?
Right, because it doesn't matter. That's the
you
other
know, a lot
thing.
Of transsexuals say, well, it's got nothing to do with sex. And I would say, well, you know what? Maybe for them it didn't. But for me, it part of it, not the only thing, but certainly a component of it was that I could not relate to people. My body wasn't the right format for the way that my brain wanted it.
Your rite of passage to be male or female. And I'm not talking about, I mean, your gender matching your body as a man or a woman to male or female, mm-hmm. part of that is the way that you relate to other people sexually. Part mm-hmm. of that is.
Yeah. I mean, it's an intrinsic part. And if you assume that I was always a woman, that I was always female psychologically, that, you know, in for someone who was born without a vagina, that that's a birth defect. I've always been a woman and I didn't have a vagina, and that's a birth defect, pure and simple. And if you just believed that in the first place, if they believed us, I mean, that's the thing, I guess, that's the most frustrating, is that I think as a community, we've relayed our experiences pretty clearly, and people simply don't believe us. There's this presumption that right. that we're either lying or we're delusional. And as long as we're in the DSM, it perpetuates that.
It makes it, right, exactly.
Those are the only two choices that are consistent with this kind of a diagnosis, mm-hmm. that we're either lying and or we're delusional, or both. And I think the simple truth is we're telling the truth. This is who we are. You don't need to analyze. You don't need some amazing psychological theory. They just need to believe us. We're telling the truth. Right. And if they just accepted what we said at face value, everything else makes sense. You know, all these things about
fetishes. We're talking
about
transsexuality
yeah.
at this point. This is we're talking about being transsexuals, and this is the part that's in the DSM that is harmful, as well as transvestic fetishism,
which they used to drag in anybody else who's gender nonconforming,
right? And those are two very separate things. Being mm-hmm. a transsexual is not.
Unfortunately,
the same.
they're both listed in the DSM under sexual and gender identity disorders.
Right. It's as a paraphilia.
I mean, which right off the bat. Even in the DSM, they're not getting the difference between sexuality and gender because they lump them together, sexual and gender identity disorders.
And how do they expect a psychologist that's supposed to be treating you to get this? So if I went to a psychologist, even as somebody who, say I'm not a transsexual person or even a transgender person at this point, and I go to a psychologist and I say, you know, I'm having, me and my wife or my husband are having issues in our relationship. When we want to fix this. Mm-hmm. We want to work on our relationship. And eventually things always turn to, well, how is your sex life? And say I disclose, well, you know, I like to be dominated. Mm-hmm. I have a paraphilia. I am now being diagnosed with a paraphilia.
Oh, yeah.
And that doesn't go away. There's no exit clause for that.
No.
And
you've been a very bad Ethan.
Oh. And I don't. Just for the record, I don't like to be dominated. I just want to tell you this. I could be dom. I could be, you know, donning the whips and chains. No, I'm just kidding. But it's just, it's, you know, don't make me spank you. But,
No, and the thing
no,
is,
but it's just the idea that no, none of these things, and I'm poking fun, but none of these things deserve any of that. You know, these are actual choices that people make, and it shouldn't be that I'm going to go now and be diagnosed as having a paraphilia because I'm fulfilling a fantasy.
Well, as Kelly Winter says, difference is not disorder.
Right, difference is not disorder.
You can be different without having anything be wrong with you.
Yep. I want to know, though, how many people out there, you know, just sink deep into your brain right now and think about what it is that turns you on. And if you're willing to talk about that, are you willing to be diagnosed over it?
I mean, they did a there's so many things about the DSM that make me insanely upset. It's hard to get them all covered in the amount of time that we have, and we're not trying to get into crazy amount of detail. But instead of eliminating transvestic fetishism, which is what our community has asked for and what IFGE passed a resolution a year ago requesting, they actually made a new subcategory of autogynephilia. You know, so they're actually making it worse. They're coming up with new ways to diagnose this, and that's based on what your sexual orientation is. And now they're saying, well, we're not going to count it as a diagnostic criteria, but we're encouraging all the therapists to record whether these people, what their sexual preferences are. And I think even though they removed homosexuality in 1973, boy, it sounds a whole lot like they're going back in the direction of pulling that back in, all of a sudden it becomes one of those things that they should be considering, and they should be recording what your sexual orientation is. And if that's not a psychological disorder, well, they would have no reason to record that. And so I think that gay and lesbian people, I think everybody should be upset by these diagnoses. It shouldn't just be the transgender people, because this isn't just going to affect us. This is going to affect anybody who likes anything other than plain vanilla sex. And even then, if you're thinking about something while you're having sex that's not quite what you're doing, that's, you know, this affects you too.
And all it does is, you know, when people don't talk about, and all it does is, it's a campaign of oppression. Because if you can't talk about it, if you can't, if you say, well, you know, people stand together and say, well, you know, this is how I feel. Well, this is how I feel. Silence is a bad thing. And when you start talking about that, now you're being diagnosed because you're talking about
and
it.
And they're taking advantage
of it. They're promoting the idea that you are going to feel guilty, that you're going to feel all of these other emotions.
As every good Catholic does.
Right, right. Or Jew. Mm-hmm. Well, Jews are born with it. Catholics are taught it, but it's, you know, it's you know, feel guilt, feel shame, feel all of the things that we've tried so hard to shed, and have come a long way with that as mm-hmm. as trans people, as gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people, any queer person, or anybody who's enjoyed sex at all. Sexual freedom, oh my goodness, think about this. They're trying to oppress.
There's a diagnosis if you don't enjoy sex. There's a diagnosis if you enjoy sex too much. There's a diagnosis if you enjoy sex with the wrong people. There's a diagnosis if you enjoy sex the wrong way.
And with the right people.
With the right people, yes.
There's a diagnosis if you enjoy sex with yourself or with an inanimate object. If you have sex with a vibrator and you don't want a boyfriend or a girlfriend, you have a diagnosis. Put your batteries away, my friends.
Batteries, batteries. I need more batteries. But it's a tool of social control, and they're taking advantage
of the fact. It's a
tool. They're taking advantage of the fact that people are embarrassed to talk about sex. They're embarrassed to admit that they enjoy sex, that our culture has instilled that inhibition in everyone. And these researchers are taking advantage of it to get more control over our lives, to make themselves look more prestigious. And in the end, no one's benefiting except for the people who get to publish these papers. The rest of us are all basically being harmed by this sort of thing. You know, I understand that there's a reason why the DSM exists, and that at some level it's a helpful tool for people with real mental illness. But just based on their own diagnosis, the criteria for mental illness says that anything where the stress is primarily a result of society not accepting you is not a mental illness. And I think for the vast majority of transgender people, whatever stress we have is because society doesn't accept us. And so by their own criteria, it's not a mental illness. And so they should be consistent, they should listen to their own words, and they should follow their own rules and realize that this is not. And again, this the new version of the DSM is going to come out in 2013. It's nearly impossible to take GID out at this point. It's going to be in there. We're hoping it's going to be a little bit better. Whatever we get, we're going to be stuck with for a long time. Mm-hmm. And so for this current version, I concede that we're stuck with having a diagnosis for gender identity disorder. And in the meantime, it's workable. We can do something with that. But we need to get the transvestic fetishism out of there. The word itself just sounds nasty. It sounds bad. Even the very name.
It pathologizes people for wearing clothing. I mean, you take it at its least, and then even take
and
it to its...
And there's a diagnosis if you don't wear clothing.
Right.
You know,
right.
Too much clothing, not enough clothing, the wrong clothing. It's pretty darn specific.
And it's scary. It's scary for all humankind. All of us. Every individual. So I can't even imagine. I mean, you know, think about different cultures. You know, this is global. It's mm-hmm. not just here in the United States.
No, I mean, so think about this is different... the American Psychiatric Association, but right. these standards affect medical care the world
everywhere.
Around. Everywhere. But there are a number of countries that are starting to look at this. I believe Sweden, over the last year, did explicitly say there is no reason and there is no benefit to having transvestic fetishism be listed as a psychological disorder. And Sweden removed that. They decided that for the time being, they're going to leave gender identity disorder because it allows them a framework with which to treat transsexuals who are asking for medical care. In France, they just passed a ruling saying, no, even transsexualism is not a psychiatric disorder. And so a number of countries around the world are starting to reject the American export of psychiatric disorders.
Oh, and why wouldn't they? I mean, think about this. Look at, we don't take the lead on things anymore. We're not the lead on social, you know, on social issues, psychological issues. Even
we used
even...
to be the beacon of freedom for the entire world, and we've fallen behind. We're a country that tortures. We're a country that represses. We're a country that just does, you know, bad things to its citizens, and we don't have privacy anymore. And we're not in the lead anymore in terms of undoing oppression. Every other country in the world, for the most part, all the other Western countries, don't care if you're gay or lesbian or trans if you want to be in the military. But in the United States, we think we can't possibly have a military and allow people who are homosexual to serve in the military.
Oh, absolutely. No, it's amazing to me that that we've fallen so far behind, and it's amazing to me that we have to go through this to talk about this. Of course we need to talk about it, but to have to educate the people that are supposed to be educating the masses as to what it is that we actually need.
You know, and the thing is that really it gets back to religion. People in the United States think that we're not a religious country. They look at other countries, like a lot of Muslim countries, and think, well, those are religious fanatics. But if you look at the numbers, there are more Americans who feel that religion is a major issue in their life. Americans are more likely to go to church, to attend services. By almost every measure, America is the most religious country in the world. We actually have more fundamentalists than most of the countries that we perceive as being repressive. And this is what bleeds over into this, is that we're very moralistic, much more so than...
Well, puritanistic, more than moralistic. It's not really religion as much as it is fanatical. And it's because we don't even... You know, there are the Sunday... Sunday
religion.
You couldn't
buy liquor in Massachusetts on a Sunday until a couple years ago. And the only reason they changed the law is because they realized everyone was going to New Hampshire to buy liquor on Sunday. And they were losing out on
which
money.
Which was a Republican state, by the way.
Yes. The only thing in the United States that outranks religion is money. I think we've for 1 week I think we've covered quite a bit here, and I know right now there are so many issues going on. We're working on trying to get ENDA passed and same sex marriage and everything. But I think for transgender people, that the DSM is a really fundamental problem. I mean, this is the foundation that our oppression is built on. That these are the very things that make it so hard to pass a law like ENDA to say that you shouldn't discriminate against us, because our enemies are going, these people are sick. These people are sick. They need treatment. We don't need to pass laws saying that this is acceptable. We need to get these people help. In religion is a choice. Religion is not an immutable characteristic. The people who are claiming their right to discriminate us, to discriminate against us based on their religion, are saying, well, they don't deserve rights because it's not an immutable characteristic, but their religion itself is not an immutable characteristic. Logically, it makes no sense.
They're just claiming moral that well, I'm better than you are.
Maybe we need to say this is a religion, that this is an article of faith for us, that we're okay, that our God created us in a way that's just fine, thank you. In my religion, the God that I believe in says that I'm okay. And if they don't believe that, then that's a difference of religion.
I'd like to thank everybody for tuning in to Trans FM this week. I'd like to thank our guest Denise LeClaire for coming on and discussing the DSM. This is one interview in a series. We'll have a variety of guests each Sunday at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to discuss the DSM. Again, thank you so much for tuning in, and you can find a recording of the show on transfm.org under the heading of DSM-5. Thanks again. Have a good night.